But today I wanted to go to the Old Testament, as Mr. Ott did, and go over some stories. The purpose of being is just try to spark some of your interest in some of the stories that are in the Old Testament, and to look at some interesting facts, and then look at the there was two different times that the children of Israel were blessed according or prophesied about what would happen to them in the future. One time was by Jacob, who was renamed Israel, and the second time was by Moses, who was speaking more about the tribes rather than the sons themselves. And so I'll get to that after a while. But I want to start with a few interesting facts in the Old Testament. Speaking of Moses, when he did give his blessing and predictions for the children of Israel, it was just prior to his death. And that's in Deuteronomy 34. So I want to start with that. And, of course, we know that Moses had displeased God by striking the rock and basically cursing the children of Israel for being so demanding. And he failed to give God the credit for bringing forth the water from the rock. But in Deuteronomy 34, verse 5, it describes Moses' death. 34 and verse 5. So Moses, the servant of the Lord, died there in the land of Moab according to the word of the Lord. And you know, he never went into the promised land. He was able to view it from a distance. And he buried him in a valley of the land of Moab. This means that God himself, or Jesus Christ of the Old Testament, he buried him in a valley in the land of Moab over against Beth Peor, but no man knoweth of his sepulcher unto this day. And Moses was 120 years old when he died. His eyes were not dim, nor his natural force abated. So it was time for the children of Israel to go into the promised land, and he had already been told that he wasn't going to do so. But God did bless him up to the very time that he died. At an age of 120 years old, it said his eyes weren't dim, as many of ours are, and none of his natural force had abated. Can you imagine that type of life, that he was just as vigorous at 120 years old at the time of his death that he had been as a young man? And it must have been a special blessing. There's probably a very good reason that God himself buried Moses, and that no man knows where his grave was, is because even today the Jewish people that in house of Israel as a whole would worship Moses above all others. Of course, the Jewish people don't believe that Christ was anything more than a prophet. They do think that he was a special prophet called of God, but they look to Moses as the greatest human to ever have lived, and more so than Jesus Christ. And if they knew where his burial place was, it would be greater probably than like Mecca is to the Arab nations. It would be a place that would probably become a problem of blasphemy against God in the worship of Moses if they knew where that grave was. And so God very knowingly made sure that no one knew where Moses was buried. Let's look in Genesis 16 at another prediction. And in the light of today's world events, it's very telling of what happened in Genesis 16. This is a prediction about the other son of Abraham and his descendants. 16, starting in verse 8. This is after, of course, Sarah had convinced Abraham to take Hagar, her handmaiden, and have a child by her, because she didn't have faith that God, she knew she was of such age it was impossible in human terms for her to have a child. So she convinces him to have a child by Hagar, and she thought she would raise it as her own and would fulfill the promise that God had made. So in verse 8, and he said, Hagar, Sarai's maid, whence comest thou, and whither wilt thou... Am I in the right place? Whither thou... Oh, okay. This is after she's fled from Sarah, to put it in context, because it wasn't making any sense to me there. But she had fled because, of course, once she had a child of her own by Abraham, they knew that it was Sarah who had been barren probably all these years. And said she looked... saw herself superior to Sarai, as she was still called at this time. So in verse 8, she's fled into the wilderness away from the wrath of Sarai. And he said, Hagar, Sarai's maid, whence comest thou, and whither wilt thou go? And she said, I flee from the face of my mistress Sarai. And the angel of the Lord said unto her, return to thy mistress, and submit thyself unto her hands. And the angel of the Lord said unto her, I will multiply thy seed exceedingly, that it shall not be numbered for multitude. Now these are the descendants of Ishmael, her son. And the angel of the Lord said unto her, Behold, thou art with child, and shall bear a son, and shall call his name Ishmael, because the Lord hath heard thy affliction. And he will be a wild man, his hands will be against every man, and every man's hand against him, and he shall dwell in the presence of all his brethren. And think about the events in the Middle East now, that the Arab nations have descended and realize they've descended from Abraham. And they feel like, of course, they're the firstborn and the more superior race to the Jewish people as they see them in that area. But it says they're a wild man among the nations. And is there any truer statement about the problems in the world that the Arab people are creating at this time? They definitely would be, and this is thousands of years ago that this was predicted, that they would be a wild man among the nations. But let's go to Deuteronomy 33, and we'll read first some of the predictions that Moses made for the family of Israel. Deuteronomy 33. Then we'll go back and read some of the things that Jacob said about his sons individually. I thought to try to go back and forth, and I realized that was going to be too much turning and become a little bit complicated trying to flip back and forth and compare them. And they actually give the predictions in a different order as well for the sons. But in 33, starting in verse 4, it says, Moses commanded us a law, even the inheritance of the congregation of Jacob. And he was king in Jeshurun. Now, this is talking about Moses, and it describes him as a king in Jeshurun. And Jeshurun was a poetic name meaning the people of Israel. It actually meant that they were kind of a called out people. And so it was a special name for Israel at that time. And it says that Moses was the king over those people. And it says the people and the tribes of Israel were gathered together. He goes on to say then, these are the predictions he made for each family starting in verse 6. Let Reuben live and not die, and let his men be few, and let not his men be few. Now it's interesting that, Genesis 35:22, I'll just read that, it says, And it came to pass when Israel dwelt in that land that Reuben went and lay with Bilhah, the father's concubine, and Israel heard it. And this Bilhah was the mother of Dan and Naphtali. And it caused a rift between Jacob and Reuben. And he really didn't have very good words for him or much of a blessing for him as he did some of the other sons. But here it says it's almost kind of like a negative blessing in a way. It says, let Reuben live and not die, and let not his men be few. So Moses knew the problems that this family would have had if God didn't bless them and help them. And then in the future, they did flourish. In 1 Chronicles 5:1, if you want to just mark that down or turn to it, 1 Chronicles 5:1, Now the sons of Reuben, the firstborn of Israel, for he was the firstborn, but forasmuch as he defiled his father's bed, his birthright was given unto the sons of Joseph, the son of Israel, and a genealogy is not to be reckoned after his birthright. So even though family line wasn't to die off and that they were not to be few, he lost a lot of the prestige of a firstborn because of this act with the concubine of his father. It says the birthright was taken from him and given to Joseph, and his genealogy is not to be reckoned after the birthright. It actually goes through a different line of the family. Deuteronomy 33:7, there's a much more lengthy prediction here. It says, And this is the blessing of Judah. And he said, Hear, Lord, the voice of Judah, and bring him unto his people. Let his hands be sufficient for him, and be thou an help to him from his enemies. And that's pretty poignant to say that God, please help Judah with his enemies. When you look at the problems that Judah has today and throughout history, the Jewish people have been hated, especially by Satan, and I would say a lot of that has to do with the fact that Jesus Christ himself was born into the family of Judah, but also the most prominent part of the family today, because most people in these different nations throughout the world don't understand that many of them could be descendants of the house of Israel. They think that the Jewish people or the only descendants. And there's an anti-Semite attitude that's growing even in Europe again. It's growing in this country. You can look at articles on the internet where people make comments about the articles, problems between the Palestinians and Israel, some of the hatred that people have for the Jewish people. It's unreasonable. And it's the type of thing that I don't know whether it's considered fashionable or whether it's something they've learned from their father or someone before them, or if it's just Satan that puts it in their mind. But Satan does seem to have a special hatred for the Jewish people, and it tends to translate into problems throughout the world and a lack of support for them. But it goes on, and with Levi in verse 8 it says, "And of Levi he said, let thy Thummim and thy Urim be with thy Holy One, whom thou didst prove at Massah, and with whom thou didst strive at the waters of Meribah." Now Levi, you know, became the, that was the same tribe that Aaron and Moses were born into, and they became the priesthood for all the nations. But they didn't always have such a glorious position in the minds of the people, and we'll go back and read that later when we read about what Jacob himself had to say about it. But the Thummim and the Urim, no one really knows exactly what they were as far as the looks of it or how, but they do know that it was something that gave God's will and special, and the high priest kept it in the breastplate. Some people think it was a white and a black stick with special wording on it. Some think it was clear stones. But truth be known, it never really describes exactly what they are, but it was a mechanism by which the priest could ask for God's instruction on, and they were really considered light and even in perfection in light. So one wasn't negative, but the other was better. And so, again, no one really knows what it means. It's mentioned about five or six times in the Old Testament, when it talks about the Thummim and the Urim, and Urim is mentioned several more times by itself, even up to the time of Saul, who tried to ask God's will through the use of those. It talks about the fact that they proved themselves at Massah and about the waters of Meribah. Now, this is where Moses struck the rock. And those two words, remember, a lot of the people were grumbling and complaining, and when Moses asked who stood with him, men of Levi were always quick to do so because, of course, they were of the same family. But the Massah and Meribah in the Hebrew means testing and quarreling, or testing and strife. So all these different names have a very specific meaning, and that was what it was named, and yet Levi stood by Moses in support of him and Aaron at that time of trouble among the children of Israel. It goes on in verse 9, this is talking about Levi, who said unto his father and to his mother, I have not seen him, neither did he acknowledge his brethren, nor know his own children, for they observed thy word and kept thy covenant. So it means that they were looking to God's covenant more than even family and friends and mother and father, which, of course, we know is a proper attitude for those that love God. It's not a negative thing, but it means they had that much faith in God. In verse 10, it says, they shall teach Jacob thy judgments, and Israel thy law. They shall put incense before thee and whole burnt sacrifices upon thine altar. Bless, Lord, his substance, and accept the work of his hands. Smite the loins of them that rise against him, and them that hate him, that rise not again. So a little bit more detail about Levi, which you would think, since they were going to be the priesthood, and they were actually part of the immediate family and descendants of the same family that Moses and Aaron were part of. In 12, it talks about Benjamin. And of Benjamin he said, the beloved of the Lord. And so he gives a special recognition for who Benjamin is. And, of course, that goes back to the fact that their father, Israel or Jacob, had a special love for Benjamin and Joseph both because of their mother. It says, and of Benjamin, he said, the beloved of the Lord shall dwell in safety by him, and the Lord shall cover him all the day long, and he shall dwell between his shoulders. So it sounds like a very nice blessing. We're going to read a story here later to see, though, that Benjamin suffered some very difficult times. But, of course, then again, these predictions would hold true. You'd think when we get to this one story later on that it didn't really hold true as in the way it was promised here. Verse 13, speaking of Joseph, and of Joseph he said, blessed of the Lord. So here again, a special recognition of Joseph. Blessed of the Lord be his land, for the precious things of heaven, for the dew and for the deep that coucheth beneath, and for the precious fruits brought forth by the sun, and for the precious things put forth by the moon, and for the chief things of the ancient mountains, and for the precious things of the lasting hills. So a very physical blessing that they would inherit ancient mountains and precious things of the lasting hills. And he goes on to say, and for the precious things of the earth and fullness thereof, and for the goodwill of him that dwelleth in the bush, let the blessing come upon the head of Joseph and upon the top of the head of him that was separated from his brethren. So a very lengthy, compared to the others, very lengthy prediction and a blessing upon Joseph, who did suffer at the hands of his brothers, and yet worked for good in Egypt through through God's will. So a very special physical blessing upon his descendants. And of course, it's thought today by many in the church, and I don't know if we could actually prove this, but it's pretty much thought to be so that Ephraim and Manasseh, of course, are the English-speaking people, primarily Britain and the United States. And with this type of blessing, that would make sense. And of course, we know the whole nation's not Ephraim and Manasseh, but this is the inheritance that was given to Ephraim and Manasseh. Some of the best part of the world with the great agriculture, and Britain, of course, is still the center of the world as far as banking and finance, even though New York City is probably second to that. So it still holds a very special place in the riches of the world as far as Britain and the United States. And it probably goes back to this particular blessing that Moses revealed through the will of God. And of course, in New Jerusalem, we'll get to that later on, but spoke to this once before about the fact that Dan doesn't have an inheritance as far as the one of the gates in New Jerusalem. And Joseph actually has the two through Ephraim and Manasseh that replaces Dan among the 12 that are part of the New Jerusalem gates. He goes on, his glory is like the firstling of his bullock, and his horns are like the horns of the unicorn, which is a rhinoceros, not some mythical thing, but a very powerful animal with a single horn. With them he shall push the people together in the ends of the earth. They are the tens of thousands of Ephraim, and they are the thousands of Manasseh. He goes on then about Zebulun, and of Zebulun he said, rejoice, Zebulun, in thy going out, and Issachar in thy tents. So it's interesting about these two tribes as well. Zebulun, to give you some references to where they ended up in their inheritance, they looked like they were in a landlocked area, but they actually were on one of the major rivers that flowed into the Mediterranean Sea. Today it's known as the Kishon River, or the White River, or White Nile. And it flows into the Gulf at Haifa, which you've probably heard from time to time when you hear news of Israel. It's a very important place, and because it's actually at that point where the rivers flow into the Mediterranean there, sand is very white and pure. And they think that it was credited to the Philistines, but it might go even back further to Israel, that is the birthplace of the manufacturing of glass. And so it's very interesting that it was something, a very important area of the world for something that probably was somewhat of a miracle probably to most people at that time. Because you can imagine, we today know that glass is made from sand or from silica. But at that time, it must have been a marvel to the people that had never seen anything like that before and the things that it was used for. As far as the tents of Issachar, Judah, when they set camp each time around the tabernacle, Judah had the central eastern area that they faced where the sun would rise, a very prominent area where they would pitch their tents and raise their standards. And Issachar was to the right of that. They had probably the second most important area as far as what most people would think of as a prestigious area around the tabernacle. And the tabernacle had the different tribes with their standards around it, just like the 12 gates around New Jerusalem. So it did have a significance. It did look forward to something that would happen in the future. And there was Judah, which God blessed very greatly, with the one of the prominent spots facing to the east where the sun would rise. and Issachar was there beside them. So it mentions here that Issachar was blessed in their tents. Going on in 19, it says, "They shall call the people unto the mountain. There they shall offer sacrifices and righteousness, for they shall succor the abundance of the sea and the treasures hid in the sand." So this is what I was getting about at Zebulun and Issachar. We're in this area where the treasures hidden in the sand would most likely be the production of glass, where it would actually be developed in that part of the world. I can't swear to that, but it seems kind of interesting that it was talked about treasure hid in the sand. I don't think it's talking about pirate's treasure, obviously. But so it would seem that since history tells us that glass was first manufactured in that part of the world, that would be reasonable to think that that's what that's referring to. Verse 20, "And of Gad he said, blessed be that enlargeth Gad. He dwelleth as a lion and teareth the arm with the crown of the head." So it's going to be a very powerful nation, very warlike most likely. "And he provided the first part for himself, because there is a portion of the lawgiver was he seated, and he came with the heads of the people. He executed the justice of the Lord and his judgment with Israel." So it sounds like that Gad was going to have a very important part in helping the people of Israel as a whole keep the judgments and the law of God. And he said they would be a very powerful portion of the law giving. "And of Dan, he said, Dan is a lion's whelp. He shall leap from Bashan." Now Bashan, it's interesting about Dan, because if you were to look at a map, Dan actually had two areas that they ended up settling in. One was in the north part of what we consider modern Israel. The other was down along the Gaza Strip, which even today is the area of turmoil. And that was the area, the southern part of Dan's tribe was the right against the Philistines in that area of Gaza. And so that is an area of conflict that still continues that way. And the northern area was actually the Golan Heights. So that Bashan, that's what it is, the Golan Heights, which is a very fruitful area. But it's a very, very small area, but of course it overlooks the valleys of Israel, and it's very strategic. Wanted to look at some information about Dan. Get to that in a moment. I'll come back to it because I think that's in some of my other notes here. But it said that when they went in to conquer the land, Dan never did conquer the valley below what was called the hills of Bashan, in that valley, because the king that ruled that area, a part of the Philistines, had 100 iron chariots. And so a very militaristic group. It wasn't until much later that they were actually able to depose that king and take over the land. Interestingly, if you were to, this is the thing I'm trying to encourage here, is that when you take these stories and you start looking into some of the minute details that happened throughout the history of the Old Testament, you find out that the king of I think his name was Sisera, that was king over this area that Dan was never able to conquer until later on Judah primarily was able to conquer them. And, of course, Judah was one that said they would have God's special help with their enemies. They led the charge against this Sisera, and they decimated his forces, and he fled, to the tent of a local woman and wanted to take refuge there. And when he was hiding in the tent, she fed him the very best. He asked for water and said she gave him milk, gave him, fed him very well. When he laid down to sleep, she took a tent spike and a hammer and drove it through his head. So, and then she, of course, he thought he had found a place of refuge and actually met his end there. And she was well thought of for her bravery and for what she had done in ending this king's life. So there's stories throughout the Old Testament like that, is just as Mr. Ott was talking about the story of the general from north of Israel that came down and was cured of leprosy. You can find all these different stories, and they all stem from a lot of these blessings and stuff, and you can read then into the history, as I said, how Judah was the point for all the wars and stuff, it seemed like, from then on, because God did give them this special protection from enemies. And even in this case, like I said, Dan was never able to actually subdue that area. But then later on, when Israel did subdue it, and they asked God who should be the ones to lead the charge, he said it would be Judah. And so they did have that very special protection and help from God. And they still stand strong today. I mean, you know, people realize that the Jewish people are serious about protecting what they have in the Middle East. And they live in a very bad neighborhood, a lot more so than any of us can imagine. And yet God's blessed them and helped. And he's blessed them for a reason, too, because not only was Jesus Christ of Judah, but they also were given the responsibility of maintaining the law that we can, and the books of the Bible that we able to depend on today, that they were so diligent in keeping them to the point. Someone was discussing last week where someone had spent a long time translating or copying the Bible, actually the Old Testament, and had made one error. And I forgot, it was it Joan that was talking about that? But anyway, I think Andy and some others, I was just listening, but they were discussing it. He had worked for years and years on this and made one mistake, and they destroyed it. And then he was looked down upon because he had made this one mistake. That's how serious they were about keeping the Word of God pure. Well, another interesting thing about Dan that you could research, and you can research it in history as well, and we'll look at it under some of the blessings that Jacob gave to him. There was more information given on Dan there. Dan is commonly held to belief is that they are the ones that named Denmark and the Danube River and the different things that all throughout Europe, because they were a tribe that never really fully accepted their inheritance. They were the very first tribe that fell into idolatry almost immediately. When they went into the land, they were affected by idolatry at that time, and that's the reason that they don't have the gate named for them in the New Jerusalem, because they had rejected their inheritance at that time. Well, they became a seafaring people, and of course, later on were known to be a very violent people. Probably a lot of the Viking history and all that is based upon people that were of Danish descent, seafaring, very ruthless, and had a very paganistic religion. It was about as based upon militarism, and that's about Woden and Thor and all the other different people in the Valkyrie that were instead of being angels, they were more or less women that came in the time of battle and destroyed the enemies of the Danish people. So they have a very interesting history, and a lot could be read on that, and a lot of history throughout the Old Testament that you can read about the tribe of Dan. But they also, as I said, there were some very positive things about Dan that we'll get to in a moment when we look at what Jacob had to say about him. It goes on to say, not as much, but I said he shall leap from Bashan. That was the Golan Heights. And of Naphtali, he said of Naphtali, satisfy with favor and full with blessings of the Lord, possess thou the west and the south. So a very brief prediction of where they would actually settle. And of Asher, he said, let Asher be blessed with children, let him be acceptable to his brethren, and let him dip his foot in oil. Thy shoe shall be made of iron and brass, and as these days, so shall his strength be. That's interesting about Asher, that is along the northern coastline, and it actually is right above the inheritance of Manasseh. And it talks about his foot being dipped in oil, and I think a lot of this probably has a lot to do with just like the oil in Revelation. You could interpret that as the oil that the world uses as energy. And of course, we've always thought that there is no oil in Israel. That's what was thought all along, but they have discovered now that it's there, not kind of in the same form that they found in the Dakotas and areas like that. It takes special extraction. It's different from that. It's actually encased in rock a little bit more so than the shale out. But they say that it's actually a reserve bigger than all of Saudi Arabia's reserves in oil. And it's never been developed yet. And they do now have the techniques to get that oil if they decide that the price of oil goes high enough to make it worthwhile. So it's interesting that the foot of Asher, where it comes down into Israel, is just north of the area where all this oil that goes on down into the areas southwest of Jerusalem. And also interesting, and I don't know that there's you can put a lot of stock in this, but it's just something interesting I found when you read the internet and you find all these interesting things, is that the oil derricks are made out of a combination of steel and of brass to hold down the chance of sparks between the different parts, and they're used for the oil derricks to drill for oil. So it's kind of interesting. It talks about the shoe, and actually that word shoe can be intended as shoe or as bolt, but it's of iron and brass, the very things that it's used for oil derricks to drill for oil. Again, that's just speculation, but you never know how these little things in the Bible seem so. You wonder about it. What in the world does that mean, you know, that his shoe would be dipped in oil and he would have the iron and brass? You just never know. Of course, God knows the beginning to the end, and he knew all the minutia of all these things. So it's very possible. Because as I said, for thousands of years, it just seemed like there was no energy sources there. And then up until, I think it was like in 3 or 4 years ago, they actually realized they had this type of reserves underneath Israel. It's late. It's been there all along with no one really realizing it. Well, it goes on, there is none like unto God of Jeshurun. This is talking about God, Jesus Christ of Jeshurun, who rideth upon, and again, Jeshurun was meaning the special people of Israel, who rideth upon the heavens in thy help, in the excellency of the sky. The eternal God is thy refuge, and underneath are the everlasting arms, and he shall thrust out the enemy before thee, and shall say, destroy them. Israel then shall dwell in safety alone. The fountain of Jacob shall be upon a land of corn and wine, and also his heaven shall drop down dew. Happy art thou, O Israel, who is like unto thee, O people, saved by the Lord, the shield of thy help, and who is the sword of thy excellency? And thine enemies shall be found liars unto thee, and thou shalt tread upon the high places. And of course, we know that by the time of David and Solomon, that the nation of Israel had become the most, probably the most powerful, rich nation, even though they weren't the largest necessarily. They've become very influential, being in one of the most influential parts of the world. The story goes about Queen of Sheba that came to see Solomon, to see the riches and marvel at it. It was just unreal to people to see what type of riches these people had. So those blessings really did come true. Of course, Israel, after that, it went downhill from there. We know in the latter years of Solomon that his wives turned his heart away from God, and he became involved in all these different religions. And every king, it seemed like after that, seemed to get worse and worse and worse. And you got kings like Ahab and others that are well known for their evil. And it became a real problem, and they lost a lot of these blessings. But it wasn't that God hadn't fulfilled it. But if what God blessed them with, he was able to take away again because of the problems that they had. Well, I'd like to look back now at my notes here, because like I said, there's enough information to go back and forth. It'd be a little bit difficult. So we'll go back to see what Jacob had to say about the sons. Really, it was more in detail about each son as far as his predictions for them. So we're in Genesis 49. This is late in his life. He's got the 12 sons. And, of course, he like Abraham, started off slowly. His wife of choice was unable to have children for a long time. Finally had two. But, of course, we know that Leah was kind of looked down upon and wasn't the favorite. But God did bless her. Blessed her more than any of the concubines or his other wife. So in Genesis 49... to give some predictions for the sons and the outlook of their future. Starting in verse 1, and Jacob called unto his sons and said, gather yourselves together that I may tell you that which shall befall you in the last days. So this is not what was going to happen immediately. This is what would happen to their descendants. Gather yourselves together and hear, you sons of Jacob, and hearken unto Israel your father. Reuben, thou art my firstborn, my might, and the beginning of my strength, the excellency of dignity, and the excellency of power, unstable as water. So you know, right off the bat, he's, you're my firstborn. I love you, son, but you know what? You're as unstable as water. You know, that must have made him feel good. He said, thou shalt not excel because thou wentest up to thy father's bed. Then defilest thou it. He went up to my couch. So he tells him, you're not going to prosper the way a firstborn should have. And, of course, read from Moses' statements that, and from other statements that he did lose the birthright to Joseph. And he wasn't to be considered in the genealogy as far as the firstborn. Goes on about Simeon and Levi. And talking about Simeon and Levi, I want to go back to a story in a minute, but let's read what he has to say. It says, Simeon and Levi are brethren. Instruments of cruelty are they in their habitations. O my soul, come thou not into their secret, unto their assembly. Mine honor, be thou not united, for in their anger they slew a man, and in their self-will they dig down a wall. Cursed be their anger, for it was fierce, and their wrath, for it was cruel. I will divide them into Jacob and scatter them in Israel. So these two nations, and of course we do know that Levi never really had an inheritance physically, but they were scattered as a priesthood throughout Israel. And obviously, since we know that it's inspired, that Simeon did the same, that they must have been diluted throughout the other tribes of Israel. The reason he made this comment was they had a sister that was raped by the son of a prince of the nation that they were living among. And, of course, the king, the prince, when he found out what his son had done, because his son came to him and said, you know, I want this woman. I love her. You know, it's like love at first sight. Even though he defiled her and abused, he didn't abuse her, but he may have really thought she was wonderful, but he did rape her. And he admitted to his father what he had done. And the father then went to the king or the prince of the nation and spoke with him. And they came to an agreement that they would live together in peace, even though this would happen. And he would give his daughter to the prince's son on one condition, that they be circumcised and be every man and boy be circumcised. Well, they agreed to do that, and they did it. And Simeon and Levi, filled with rage and anger, they weren't willing to accept what the compromise that their father had worked out. After they had become sore with the circumcision, they went in with a sword, just the two of them, and destroyed the whole city, every man and boy in that city. It doesn't say that they really killed the women. But that's why that was the story he was referring to in their anger and how violent they could be, that they would have gone in and just destroyed the every man, not man, woman, and child is what you would want to say, but probably every man and boy, child, they destroyed every one of them in their anger. So that's what that was referring to. So that's why he said, cursed be their anger, for it was fierce. It really was. Going on in verse 8, again, Judah has a special blessing. It says, thou art he whom thy brethren shall praise. Thy hand shall be in the neck of thine enemies. And we can see that today with the Jewish people in Israel that have returned to that land and identify themselves as Judah, that they are at the neck of the enemy. Thy father's children shall bow down before thee. So they had and of course they would, not to each and every one of them in a sense, but Jesus Christ being of the tribe of Judah, every knee shall bow to Jesus Christ when he returns. And he is of the tribe of Judah in the physical sense of when he was here on earth physically. It says, Judah is a lion's whelp, much like what it talked about Dan earlier. From the prey, my son, thou art gone up. He stooped down, he crouched as a lion, as an old lion. Who shall rouse him up? So it says he's like a lion's whelp. He's got this energy come from the prey. He's has an adult lion that's crouched down, and as crafty, I would say, is probably what it's meaning here, as an old lion. It says, who would rouse him up? You know, it's not someone to be messed with. And as I said earlier, it turned out that Judah, most of the time, was at the forefront of any of the wars and battles that they had to fight. It says, the scepter shall not depart from Judah, nor a lawgiver from between his feet, until Shiloh come. So until Jesus Christ should come again, it says, a scepter shall not depart from Judah. And there would never be a time without a lawgiver. They were the ones, again, that preserved the law so meticulously until Shiloh come, meaning when Jesus Christ. And unto him shall be the gathering of the people, shall the people be. Again, a very special blessing that Judah had by revelation from Jesus Christ and by God the Father. It says, binding his foal unto the vine, and of course the vine represents the true body of Christ, and his ass colt to the choice vine, meaning a very special vine. He washed his garments in wine and his clothes in the blood of grapes. So here again, his garments would be washed in wine, and his clothes in the blood of grapes, indicating they'd be washed in blood most likely. And that could refer not only to Jesus Christ, but the struggle that Judah as a people have had with their enemies throughout the ages. It says, his eyes shall be red with wine and his teeth white with milk, meaning they will still have an abundance of everything. Zebulun shall dwell at the haven of the sea, and he shall be a haven of ships, and his border shall be unto Zidon. And again, I said Zebulun was a little more inland, but it was on the river there, led out into a major port in the Mediterranean, an area where he says they would be a haven of ships, which he did predict. And this is long before they went into the promised land as a people. Issachar is a strong ass crouching down between two burdens. Now, I didn't try to look up the history on this because it just run into too many things, and it was a little vague as to what that might have meant. But again, it was something that's predicted for the last days. And he saw that rest was good and the land that it was pleasant, and bowed his shoulder to bear and became a servant under tribute. And they did have problems in the area where they were living. They were in an area where they had problems with some of the Philistine and the Gentile kings. And they never did fully conquer that area, even during the time of Joshua. Dan shall judge his people as one of the tribes of Israel. And Dan, it says he would judge his people. They were actually, when you read about the story of Samson was a Danite, and he was considered a judge of his time. And, of course, before they turned away from the rule of judges, Dan still had some of the people of Dan had a special calling for the tribes, that they would actually judge the people as one of the tribes. Dan shall be a serpent by the way. And this is where a lot of people think that you read a lot of the prophecies and stuff that were unexplained but seem to point in a certain direction. The history of the United States and Britain, a lot of the literature that Mr. Armstrong had written was based on some of these predictions here, that Dan shall be a serpent by the way, an adder in the path that biteth the horse heels, so that his rider shall fall backwards. They went conquering across Europe and went up into, as I said, named areas like Denmark, the Danube River, and that's supposedly what the serpent, by the way, it shows the way that the house of Israel moved north into Europe. Whether that's completely accurate or not, I don't know, but it does tend to make sense because there's so many things throughout the area of Europe that have the name Den or Dan associated with them. It says, I have waited for thy salvation, O Lord. So there's some good things about Dan early on, but of course, as I said, it was some bad times for him as well, because they were quick to turn to idolatry. Gad, a troop shall overcome him, but he shall overcome at the last. So a special prediction of what would happen with the people of Gad. Out of Asher, his bread shall be fat, and he shall yield royal dainties. So a very good prediction for the people of Asher. Naphtali is a hind let loose. He giveth goodly words. Now, that's not what you really want to hear, that you're going to give goodly words, but it could be that they had a hand in predicting and protecting their word of God in a lot of ways. And that may be the interpretation of it, possibly. It doesn't really make it clear exactly what that means. But all these had some special significance throughout the history of the house of Israel. Again, Joseph has a little more information about Joseph as a fruitful bough, even a fruitful bough by a well whose branches ran over the wall. So a very special physical blessing upon Joseph. The archers sorely grieved him and shot at him and hated him. But his bow abode in the strength, and the arms of his hands were made strong by the hands of the mighty God of Jacob. From thence is the shepherd and the stone of Israel. So again, if you look at the most powerful nations throughout the most modern part of history, it would have been Great Britain, and then followed by the United States. And again, it says here that they would be people that a lot of people would hate. And of course, the United States is hated by a lot of people. Some of it's through jealousy. It's also because people do have a tendency to be jealous. They think we interfere too much in the other world affairs. So it would make sense that Joseph might be those that's specially blessed. Blessed, as it said, is a fruitful bough that runs over the wall because of water. And the archers sorely grieved him and shot at him, hated him, but his bow abode in strength. Most powerful army in the nation of the world, in the history of the world. Going on in 25, it says, "Even by God of thy father who shall help thee, and by the Almighty who shall bless thee with blessings of heaven above, blessings of the deep that lieth under, blessings of the breast and of the womb," meaning that they would be blessed in the number of members of this particular family. They'd be blessed in the heavens, be blessed in the things of the earth. "The blessing of thy father has prevailed above the blessings of my progenitors unto the utmost bound of the everlasting hills. They shall be on the head of Joseph and on the crown of the head of him that separate from his brethren." So again, a special physical blessing upon this nation of strength, of that would prosper more than any progenitor prior to that time. And I don't know what a group of people other than the English-speaking people could lay hold of that promise. "Benjamin shall raven as a wolf. In the morning he shall devour the prey, and at night he shall devour the spoil." So again, kind of not something that you really want to think upon, that he would be that type of person, that they would be ravening as a wolf, which most people have a very negative attitude toward, and he would divide the spoil. It says, "All these are the 12 tribes of Israel, and that is that their father spake unto them and blessed them, every one according to his blessing he blessed them. And he charged them and said unto them, I am to be gathered unto my people, bury me with my fathers in the cave that is in the field of Ephron in the Hittites." And it goes on, of course, he reminisces about Abraham and Sarah to his children here as he gave them these blessings. So it's very interesting that there's some similarities and some different details in the things that he spoke to. And by the way, that daughter of was Dinah. She was the one that was raped, that Simeon and Levi revenged upon the prince's son, upon the whole city of that people. Just some other scriptures that reference some of these different nations. I'll just mention them. 1 Chronicles 12:33. It says, "Of Zebulun, such as went forth to battle, expert in war, with all instruments of war, 50,000 which could keep rank, they were not of double heart." So they were a very focused people. It says they didn't have a double heart. And they were able to go out by rank, meaning they were a very organized army. Zebulun and Naphtali were a people that this is in Judges 5:18. It talks about Zebulun and Naphtali, the nature of those people. "Zebulun and Naphtali were a people that jeopardized their lives unto the death in the high places of the field." So they had no fear of death. They were willing to jeopardize their very existence. And it says they weren't, as it said about Zebulun, that they were expert in war, were able to operate in ranks, and they had no double heart about their commitment. Again, Dan's heritage was the name of Dan means judge. He was actually the son of Rachel's handmaiden Bilhah. That's the one that Reuben was cursed somewhat by his father for having an affair with. And again, Samson in that was where he talked about Bilhah being the mother of Dan. That's in Genesis 35:25. As far as the children of Ephraim in 1 Chronicles 12:30, It says, and of the children of Ephraim, 20,800 mighty men of valor, famous throughout the house of their fathers. So they were famous for their valor. This is Ephraim. It talks about all the other family, but the only two that really talks about being so valorous was Zebulun, Naphtali, and also Ephraim, where it mentions specifically that they were very valiant and valorous. As far as Benjamin, let's look to finish up. I want to go to a story and kind of skip through it and then show the results of it. Show that things weren't always rosy for everyone. And again, it said that Benjamin was as a ravening wolf. So let's go to Judges. To give this some context before I get into it, this is where the man was traveling with his concubine, and he became outraged because she had been defiled, supposedly. You know, he wasn't very outraged about himself that he had left her outside the home while he was safely inside the home. And she was the one that then when he found her dead body at the outside the door in the morning, he took her body and cut it into 12 pieces and sent it to all the tribes of Israel. And they were outraged and wanted to know what had happened. And, of course, he made it known that that some men in the area of Benjamin had been the ones to do this while he was traveling with his concubine. Of course, he kind of overlooked the fact of his rude and crude behavior toward her because it said he really didn't care about her until this had happened. But anyway, the people were just, you know, it was unbelievable. They said nothing like this has ever happened, you know, throughout Israel and all its history. And they went out to take revenge upon Benjamin. So in chapter 20 of Judges, it says, then all the children of Israel went out, and the congregation was gathered together as one man from Dan even to Beersheba, unto the land of Gilead, unto the land of Mizpah. And the chief of all the people, even all the tribes of Israel, presented themselves in the assembly of the people of God, 400,000 footmen that drew sword. So here's 400,000 from the different tribes except Benjamin that have gathered together to avenge this. To skip over some of this, they go to the primary cities of Benjamin and demand that Benjamin, the people of the cities of Benjamin, give up these men that had so had defiled this concubine to the point where she was cut up and passed around among the nations. Well, they refused to do it. Well, the the people of different tribes then swore that none of their daughters would ever marry any one of Benjamin, and also that they would exact justice upon these people that had treated this concubine. So they held the whole nation or the whole family of Benjamin responsible for it, since they wouldn't give up the individuals who were actually involved in doing so. So they fought back and forth on two occasions. They asked God, should they fight against Benjamin? And God said yes. And so they went out and fought against Benjamin, and Benjamin killed tens of thousands of these 400,000. Well, they got discouraged and went back and asked God again, should we go out and fight again, or are we doing the right thing, the wrong thing? And he said, yes, go fight again. And again, they go, and of course, Judah, in one instance, he tells them to let Judah lead the charge against Benjamin. Well, again, it doesn't go well for the other tribes. More tens of thousands were killed. So the third time, they go and they ask God, should we go out again against them, or is this a mistake? But this time they fasted as a group of people. They fasted and they offered sacrifice to God, and God said, yes, go out again. This time God was with them, and they drew the people of Benjamin out of their strongholds by making them think they had drawn them out, thinking that, again, they were going to get the best of the other tribes of Israel. And so the men of Benjamin come out and went after them. And while they were doing that, other members of the tribe went back and set fire to the city. Well, when they looked around and saw that it happened, they went back toward the city. And as they went back, there was an ambush set for them. And they killed thousands and thousands and thousands of the Benjamite men. They killed so many of them and they killed the women and children in their cities. I mean, they just went on a rampage to basically cleanse the land of anybody of the house of Benjamin, to the point that only a few thousand escaped into the mountains of Ramon, I believe was the name of the mountain. I'm not going to read all of that because it's a fairly lengthy story here. But I wanted you to get the gist of how interesting some of these stories could be when you start looking into the history of these different people. So the few survivors went into the mountains in hiding and said they hid there for 4 months because they were afraid that they would come and destroy them. Well, then when the other tribes realized that they came close to actually destroying the house of Benjamin, it says they repented themselves. And they didn't know what to do because they had swore that none of their daughters would be able to marry a people of Benjamin. So they decided then that they went into one of the Gentile areas and killed all of the men and women and children except those young women that were virgins. And those that were survived, they told the men of Benjamin, said, you can have these women as your wives. But still there wasn't enough for those men that did survive. So then they had a what they called a festival to Shiloh, where part of the tribes would go out and their women would dance in this festival called the Festival of Shiloh. Well, the other tribes decided they wouldn't, the women that were going to go out there in the cities that they were from, that they wouldn't tell them what their plans were. But they told the men of Benjamin, said, when these virgins go out to dance, said, we will stand back and you can go in and pick yourselves wives of these women in the Festival of Shiloh. Which they did, and then the men of these different families that where their women were taken, they became angry about it, and they told them, said, well, the reason we didn't tell you what was going to happen is because we had all sworn that we wouldn't allow our women to marry a man of Benjamin, and if you didn't know about it, you couldn't be guilty of it. So they colluded among themselves to allow this to happen, so that the men some of their women had been taken by Benjamin wouldn't go back on their vow. But of course they, as I said, they had repented themselves and asked God what they should do, because they nearly wiped out the tribe of Benjamin. And as we read that Benjamin was very strong, ravening almost like a wolf as far as their ferocity and everything. So they had took them three tries to exact this vengeance upon them, but they finally had to repent of their attitude of doing it themselves, and fast and sacrifice to God and ask for his help to finally conquer the tribe of Benjamin. And then, as I said, they came close to destroying the tribe of Benjamin. And then they had to kind of manipulate the situation to allow that tribe to once again flourish, which they did because they were part of the people that stayed with Judah, with King David, King Solomon's son, whenever the house of Israel and Judah split. Benjamin stayed loyal to the kingly family and stayed with Judah. So they did have a loyalty and probably a fierceness about them that was valued probably by the people of Judah at that time. And of course they've kind of blended together where you didn't know who they were, but they had lived in the area of Jerusalem and stayed loyal to David's lineage. So some very interesting stories, some predictions about these people, and some things that you can look into, and all these little things that are so pertinent today, just as I said about the sons of Ishmael, where they're like a madman among the nations, among their brethren. And that's exactly the situation they find today. And I think as we see more and more, it's much like so many of the predictions that God makes and revelations, that we think we may understand what's going on, and then when it actually occurs and we look back with that, well, that wasn't what I expected, but that makes sense. And a lot of these predictions for the last days, I'm sure it'll be the same way when we know the true identity of even though we don't know where these children of Israel are and how they're spread among the nations and how there's other people among them, God does know them. He knows the genealogy. He knows who's who. And he's probably, just as he's made sure that there was a blessing for Abraham throughout the ages, he's made sure that Abraham's seed has flourished and is greater than, so great that they can't be numbered. And God knows who and where they are and what each one of them and what part they played, and how these predictions, both by Jacob and by Moses, has played out, whether they've been fulfilled yet or whether some of them will still be fulfilled. And again, you can go look at Revelation about the tribes, how they're mentioned there, and read about how God will call so many of each tribe to create the 144,000. He has to know who they are if he's going to call them and make sure that there's the 144,000, so many thousand of each tribe. So God knows who they are. He knows what these blessings meant, and he will fulfill them.